Hello, friends. I'm James Christopher, and welcome to the Let's Get To Neighborhood. I wrote you all a song, and I wanted to sing it for you. I hope you like it. I hope you like it as much as I like you. Now we all know 2020 has sucked. No minor leagues, man frauds passed the buck. Would we play ball? Could we play ball? Would there be some baseball? Now life's always better in a baseball park. Hot dogs and hardball and dogs that bark. Would we play ball? Could we play ball? Would there be some baseball? Now I wanted a full season just like you. I wanted to drink cold beers with you. But we made the most in a most beautiful way. Shared pics and stories from our favorite days. We did the best we could possibly do. Would we play ball? Could we play ball? Would there be some baseball? But we've got more baseball left to go. More of the greatest game you know. We'll do the best that we can possibly do. So much more baseball on Let's Get To.
Welcome to Let's Get To, the baseball podcast from the fans' perspective. Now here's your host, James Christopher.
And welcome to Let's Get To. I'm your host, James Christopher. And yeah, I came up with the whole idea of doing that song because I bought this really sweet Mr. Rogers Astros cardigan from Mitchell and Ness. I didn't like the postseason shirts this season. So, and you know, we didn't win a championship for the division. So I wanted to get some new gear. And this is what I came up with in case I start becoming a professor and then maybe I find hidden treasure, but that's for another segment on the show. I do have two gripes with MLB, and I'm going to start with the postseason shirts. I hate the fact that they're all the same. And I got to think that a lot of you fans out there feel the same way. I hate the idea that all of them say respect wherever. First of all, I don't know what that means. I guess I don't get it. I didn't like when they all look the same any other year. I hate the fact that all the division championships look the same. I think that you would find better sales if you could find a way to make them feel organic to the actual city in which they're from. That leads me to another issue. I put my ball cap on because I dress up to watch games. And as I record this at about 4 o'clock Central Time on Tuesday, the Astros are playing game two of their ALDS. They are playing middle of the day while everybody's at work. And I understand. I am a media guy. If I owned TBS, I would want the Yankees at night and the Dodgers at night. That's what a network wants. A network wants those games prime time, though I do think it also sucks for our friends in New York. The Hitter has talked about it already. Those games starting at 8 or 9 o'clock, it's awful for them too. But I get having the Yankees in prime time. If I'm a TV network, again, I want them on prime time too. The problem is how short-sighted it is. It's short-sighted because the reason why you have a big ratings gap between certain teams playing and other teams playing is because Major League Baseball does nothing to promote other teams. We've talked about this before, but it will be, I think, the death knell of the league or the thing that will really usher in even more financial problems. Until you promote yourself as a league, until you make a point of letting every brand get exposed so that way you have the ability to, for financial reasons and all of that other stuff, to make a point of getting every single major league team into the public eye at some point, you're always going to have this situation where the major league front office is going to be sitting around rooting for certain teams to make the playoffs. I've said it before and I've said it again. The NFL doesn't care if the Cowboys are in the Super Bowl or not. Their ratings aren't if they are affected by the Cowboys making the Super Bowl, it's marginal. You see a cliff when it's Astros and Nationals, not Astros Dodgers. And it isn't the Astros that are the draw. So Major League Baseball, I think, really needs to figure out a way to promote themselves as a league, to make sure that things are equitable at the league. And frankly, as much as I don't love the expanded playoffs, that's a good start. But would it have really hurt for Major League Baseball to put this Astros A's series on primetime, the second game at least. Sure, give game one, game three, Yankees, Rays. What about game two? I mean, heck, MLB, you spent all this time making the Astros your villain. Don't you want to get a little payoff for that and maybe see all of them get, I mean, maybe people would turn on and advertisers would pay head over fist to get for to watch the Astros get hit all the times we were told they were going to get hit in the first place. What? Oh, they really weren't hit marginally at all? Okay, never mind. Scratch that.
Holler and a Swaller, a chug of ballpark brew. Presented by The Hitter Sports.
And we're back here on Let's Get To with Holler and a Swaller. And you know, as we've explained, as the season of baseball that we cover the most on this show, minor leagues, independent leagues, that kind of thing, has phased out, and in some cases of the affiliated minor leagues didn't happen, some of what we tried to do on Holler and a Swaller, we weren't able to. The focus was always supposed to be ballpark brew. And so what we've tried to do is pivot instead to maybe some local beers or local, not even just to Texas, but microbrews from other states, other areas, to kind of highlight some of the parts of the country that make great beer. And we've had some really great discoveries, and I am so excited about the one that we discovered for today's episode. So first of all, it's from Texas Leaguer Brewing, which is out of Missouri City, Texas. And I'm going to try to get these guys on the show to have them come on and talk about their beer on this particular segment because I love it. First of all of the beer has a baseball themed name to it. And for example, some of the beers they have the 643. They have the Knucklebock, which we'll be trying today. And then they have Mr. Oktoberfest and maybe my favorite deep dive, if you will, the Cup of Coffee, which of course is a porter with coffee in it and an 8% alcohol by volume. Not bad. But no, I love the design of it. It's got that old classic baseball card look. This is exactly everything about being in my wheelhouse. And I'll give a little bit about the brewery from their website. Like America's Great Pastime, Texas Leaguer Brewing, established in 2017, helps people enjoy great beer for everyone to experience and enjoy. As an independent brewery, Texas Leaguer is dedicated to brewing with integrity. They use high-quality ingredients to deliver brews that cultivate fans and hustle it out every day to keep them in the stands. And so we're going to be having the Knucklebock, and a Bock is my favorite style of beer. You know, being a Texan, not being far from Shiner, it has to be. But there are a lot of great Bocks coming out of the state, and the Knucklebock is definitely one of the best ones I've had. As they describe it again on their website, we bet you didn't see this one coming because it's a knuckleball. This is a one-of-a-kind Bock that's packed full of rich flavors, yet is surprisingly smooth. Baffle your friends when you hand them a Knucklebock. So I'm going to be ordering some gear. I'm going to be ordering some more beer. We're going to try to get Nathan Reese, owner of the brewery, on the show. But until then, we send this out to all of our baseball fans out there as the ALDS and the NLDS are underway. So again, this is a segment brought to you by The Hitter Sports. Follow him at The Hitter Sports on Twitter. So to The Hitter Sports, we say, holler and a swaller, baby. So this episode drops Wednesday morning. You got baseball to watch. I'm going to sit here and continue to enjoy this excellent German-style dark lager, the Knucklebock.
Raiders of the Lost Diamond, a look into baseball's past.
And we are excited to dive into Raiders of the Lost Diamond, back with Andrew Nelson. Andrew, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I've had time to get over my playoff loss.
I think mine's still impending, so I'll let you know how it goes. I'm not what you'd call confident about how it's going. But, you know, baseball is about more than wins or losses. So let's talk a little bit of whoever it is you've unearthed on your mission.
All right. Well, this week's dive back into baseball history, we're going to talk about the Miami Marlins, but not those Miami Marlins.
Pretty sneaky, sis.
As you know, the current Miami Marlins are on yet another improbable playoff run, but they were not the first baseball team from Miami to play under that moniker. Hmm. In fact, the Marlins name goes way back in the baseball annals of South Florida. The first Miami baseball team called the Marlins arrived in 1955 when the Syracuse Chiefs were moved south by their owners, Sidney Salomon, future owner of the St. Louis Blues.
I'm just having a, I'm trying to imagine the ownership selling that to their employees. Hey, we're going to move from Syracuse to Miami.
Right.
They probably made that announcement in February. They're like, hey, cool.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if they had air AC down there.
Yeah.
At that time, probably. The Chiefs had been successful on the field, but they drew dead last in the International League. So, that was the motivation behind moving. They continued as a Phillies affiliate in the AAA International League in 1956. And the Marlins' initial lineup featured longtime Philly and Astro relief pitcher Turk Farrell, starting pitcher Don Cardwell, who would spend several years all across the National League, and longtime New York Giant Sid Gordon winding down his career. And most famously, Satchel Paige.
Okay.
Satchel would pitch in 37 games for the Marlins, starting 10 of them, and accumulated a 1.86 ERA over 111 innings and an 11-4 record. He also gathered 6 hits in 42 plate appearances, including 2 doubles, and drove in 6 runs. On August 7th, the team set a minor league attendance record when 57,000 fans came to see Paige beat the Columbus Jets at the Orange Bowl.
What? A minor league game in the Orange Bowl?
Yeah.
Nuts.
The Marlins would finish their first year with a record of 80-71 for third place out of 8 teams in the International League. In 1957, Satchel Paige would return to the Marlins, but not on-field success. The team's record slipped to 75-78 for a fourth place finish. Paige, throwing in his age 50 season, still hurled 119 innings over 40 games, 8 of which he started.
Wow.
Had a 10-8 record and a 2.42 ERA. The 1957 Marlins also featured longtime future manager Whitey Herzog in their outfield.
Okay.
In 1958, the Marlins would slip still a little further, finishing 75. No, I guess not further, but further in the standings. 75-78 with a fifth place finish. The 58 team would also be Satchel Paige's last with the Marlins. Although he was also slipping somewhat, he still threw 110 innings over 28 games with 15 starts.
Man.
Had a 10-10 record and a 2.95 ERA. The International League Marlins had soldiered on for 2 more years, continuing losing records and declining attendance. They'd continue to be a Phillies affiliate through 1959, and then in 1960, they were an Orioles affiliate. In 1961, the team made an affiliation agreement with the St. Louis Cardinals and moved down to San Juan, Puerto Rico, where they still played as the Marlins, but they only stayed in San Juan for a month before moving to Charleston, to West Virginia, where they also played as the Marlins.
Wait, strangely, isn't Charleston, West Virginia landlocked?
Yes, very okay. much so.
Tradition, I guess.
Strangely, this tumultuous year was the Marlins' best on-field performance with an 88-66 record for second place in the International League. In 1962, the Marlins moved yet again, this time to Atlanta, where they picked up the famous Crackers moniker because the longtime AA team had disbanded it at that time. They played there until 1966 when the Braves moved to town, and then they moved to Richmond, Virginia to become the Richmond Braves. The franchise lives on after a couple more moves as the Braves' current AAA affiliate, the Gwinnett Stripers.
Oh, cool. That's kind of cool that you could trace it back that far. Okay.
Yeah.
Just for some reason, I just sort of thought the Stripers were something they just drew up. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And it's another fish name. So that's,
and they're both cool fish. That's right.
Yeah. Baseball didn't leave Miami for very long. The Florida State League moved into in 1962. The FSL would franchise would carry several different monikers, including the Marlins from 1962 to 1970, and again from 1982 to 1988. In 1991, the then Miami Miracle moved to Fort Myers. That's the hat. And the Magic City would have to wait only one more year until Major League Baseball arrived with the then Florida Marlins, who've played in Miami ever since.
And have made now what, seven postseasons and have never lost a post. No,
they're 7-0 in postseason series.
Right. Yeah. Right.
They've never won a division title, but they've won two World Series.
It's so nuts. It's why baseball is the dumbest game we've ever invented.
The dumbest and the best.
And the best. Yeah. You know, it's funny because you're wearing your miracle hat and I've got one. Oh, you can't see it, but right up there. I will be honest, for as much as I always appreciate a good rebrand, I was pretty disappointed in the miracle rebrand of the Mighty Muscles.
It was very much a situation for me where I didn't know I missed something until it was gone.
Oh.
Like, I never loved the miracle branding that much. Partly because if you look at like the M and the palm tree, it's kind of off kilter and off center. It looks odd on a hat. Yeah. But I was really, I'm still not won over by the Mighty Muscles. Purple and gray are kind of weird colors. Uh-huh. I don't know. I mean, it'll probably grow on me, but I was really disappointed that all of a sudden the miracle merch went away and then they brought it back for a flash sale one day. So I picked up that faux back hat that you've got.
Oh, that's my, yeah, that's an all-time great one. You know, before we get out of here, you know, it's funny because obviously a lot of the times when you've had a Raiders, it's been about a team whose name is passed on, and clearly there's some pressure for Cleveland to perhaps rebrand.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's the direction they're going to go, is to find something from their past, or do you see something brand new, or what would you prefer as a fan, I guess?
There's a lot of steam behind the Spiders, I think, and I'd be okay with that. I think that you can do some really cool branding with Spiders, like on your hat. I love the Fond du Lac Dock Spiders. I think they do really great work with their branding. It's really fun, but also slightly menacing looking.
Yeah.
So I think that's cool. As far as the historic teams, team names go, there aren't a ton of different ones. I mean, there's the Spiders and the Broncos and the Blues. They're not going to be the Cleveland Naps because nobody knows who Napoleon Lajoie is anymore. Yeah, I'd be happy with Spiders. I mean, pretty much anything is an improvement over Indians. I'd love to see it go. I wish they'd just gone with the Cleveland baseball team, like the Washington football team has this year.
Okay, so that's an interesting point, and you know, we've got a little extra time. I don't really like Cleveland Indians. I have less problem with the Spokane Indians.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you feel that way too? That it's not the Indian word necessarily.
It's not necessarily, but I mean, they only got rid of Chief Wahoo, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Like, and there's still a bunch of people who are really pissed off about it, and people who show up in terrible headdresses and things. Whereas the Spokane Indians, I mean, they have huge buy-in from their local native community. They really do a lot of outreach, and like, I think they do really cool stuff there.
And I know that they had a help with the brand design. Like they had they have a say. No, yeah. Okay, cool. I mean, I'm on the same page. I don't know. Like I don't know how I feel about Braves, but I don't think the tomahawk chop should be a thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's, I know it's a weird.
Yeah. I'm on the same page. I mean, if you get local buy-in, if you work with your local native community, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, like the Florida Seminoles and the Utah Utes, like they work with those tribes and have agreements with them. So that's, you know, that's good. Like,
right.
That's respectful. It's not doing this and making, you know, horribly offensive chants.
Offensive. Yeah, no. Okay. Well, yeah, we're definitely on the same page then. All right, Andrew, we will have you back on in just a few weeks. Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
Talk to you soon.
Have a good one, Jim.
On deck. The Let's Get To interview, brought to you by Marco Fine Arts.
All right, so we're excited to welcome to our on-deck segment, our interview of the week, Michael Schwab, who is an investigative reporter out of Houston, Texas. He's worked for Politico, USA Today. And as he has on his Twitter feed, when he's not putting people in his wall of shame or Astros manner, he's trying to highlight some of the hypocrisy. First of all, Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, Astros are playing now. So when this goes live, I'll have the answer about that. But I'm feeling pretty good about life right now.
I'm feeling good about life, too. I think Bassett's going to get knocked down. I hope I didn't just jinx us. I brought up Astros manner, which is the thing that you kind of created based on John Boy's typo, which, by the way, I love everything about that. But you know, you've been talking a lot about the sign stealing. Why is it that I feel like baseball fans and baseball media have embraced what they know is a hypocritical stance when it comes to how they're covering the Astros and the signs?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is that the Astros are the villain now. I think it's moved. We've taken the place from the Yankees, and now the Astros have taken that for some reason. You know, it's funny. You know, I worked in the media for many years, and it's funny how media shifts work. It's, you know, I'm not going to say that there is a true bias in how this works, but, you know, going back to my days of working for major companies and worrying about clicks, you follow the trends and you follow where people are talking. You literally go on Twitter and you say, what's everyone talking about? There you go to googletrends.com and you say, what's everyone Googling? Well, everyone's Googling the Astros cheating and everyone's upset and butthurt about it. So all these media sites are going to lean in heavily to that because they want to get those clicks. Now, do they actually care about the integrity of the game? It's really hard to say. Do they really care about selling clicks and selling sponsorships? That's usually what we see for the big ends. And that's why you'll see someone like Golf Digest say, oh, Oral Hershiser just schooled Altuve. It's like, who cares? But they want the clicks for it. So the hypocrisy that I'm trying to bring to light is that we all know that baseball has been a shamble in regards to cheating since the beginning. And you find it on my Twitter page, Michael Schwab 13. I have a Twitter thread of all the hypocrisy all the way back to 1874, I believe, where there's just been just so many forms of stealing that we've seen. And it's not just the guy on second base. I'm talking about a dude in the bullpen or up somewhere on a light pole. And you're like, this is crazy. And it's like, then you're like, well, cameras are like, well, did you see how they used to do it? Right. So, you know, my main thing to bring it back to old Jam Boy is that, you know, it's easy to laugh at it and say cheaters, but people aren't looking in the mirror. And so John Boy said, you know, the Astros did it in a manner that no one else has done it. And he said it M-A-N-O-R. And I'm like, well, a manner, you know what? That's a big old castle type thing. Let's make Astros managed. So
that's where
we're just school. Yeah.
Like, all right. You know, I do think one of the things I noticed, because I'm in media in a different form of it than you are, but it does seem like anytime the news cycle slows down for Major League Baseball, there is a new story, which now is much ado about nothing about this. That's what you're talking about, right?
I mean, that's pretty the main thing. I mean, we're talking about off-season baseball when you get The Athletic doing the first major story. And then you have the other big one, the Wall Street Journal. That was also the off-season. You know, there's nothing going on and their people are looking hard for it. And you know, reporters are going to dig when they feel like they need to. Now, are they going to dig to find the truth all the time, especially what are the other teams doing? They probably won't. And I can't speak truly about what I know about this, but I do know that there are several national reporters who are in the pockets of Major League Baseball or other teams because there is this give or take. You're going to give me information. I'm not going to cover you in a wrong way. And it's just this nasty situation that existed for so many years because that's how people hear the stories. And so I go to the Yankees letter and let's talk about that for a second.
Sure.
You know, not many people are covering that because there's a lot of things in there that's going to make it hard for these news sites to do. Now in media, you have this thing called aggregation. And what that means is that if Wall Street Journal posts this story about the Astros, me at ESPN or New York Post is going to grab clips from that pieces. I'm going to take the headline and I'm going to try to go off that search. Well, you haven't seen that happening with the Yankee letter at all. Now that's a lot to me because what it says is you could easily do that, but no one's searching it. No one outside of Houston cares. So all these sites are like, we're going to turn our nose to it. We're not even going to deal with it. And so, you know, when there's a car wreck, all these news sites say, you know, this is where the car wreck happened. Well, no one's following it because they don't care. They only care about one thing, to prove that the Astros are the worst team in baseball. So it's really fascinating. It's kind of a disgusting mess in regards to media.
I opened my show talking about baseball's problem with the Yankees. And I don't mean from the Yankee letter, but I mean the fact that the baseball has positioned themselves to be dependent on the Yankees and the Dodgers doing well, because that's where ratings come from. You wouldn't see that if to use the NFL example, I'm a Cowboys fan. They will dig up dirt on the Cowboys because there isn't that same incentive of the NFL to make sure the Cowboys are good. Lord knows they've sucked for 30 years. So clearly, but I mean, but that's again, like you, it doesn't surprise me that we would find out that there might be reporters who would be incentivized to not dig up dirt on the Yankees, because that is where the money comes from.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about the, you know, I'm not going to say this is like the coastal bias in sort of a political sense. I mean that in a sports sense. You have big money makers in Los Angeles and New York, and this is where the major marketing is coming from. And it's important for them to make sure everything's doing fine there, because when you get a World Series, that's the Nats and the Astros, they're going to say, nobody cares. And the ratings are there. I mean, you get the Yankees in there, even if people hate them, they're watching it.
Sure.
So, you know, there is kind of this different mindset about, we got to take care of our own. I mean, you see it right now with the Lakers. Everyone's going nuts over LeBron James being in there because it's LA. And so I don't want to say it's something to the degree where like they're covering up because, oh, it's so secret. They're just trying to do their job to a certain degree. And they don't want to stir too much because they're going to lose a lot of their, you know, they're going to lose their access. And if your reporter doesn't have access, then you're screwed. The bias is there, and they see it on how it's treated on other teams. And they know for a fact that this has been going on, the whole video sign stealing, for years.
And I think we're going to start to see some of that. I think you talked about this on Twitter too, Orange Team Bad. We're going to start to see a lot of that when some of the players leave, and they will sort of become exonerated as a result of them leaving the Astros and moving on to someone else.
And that's happening right now with Marwin Gonzalez. I mean, he was on, you know, he's on the Twins. He was a part of it.
Tony Adams, the biggest user of the banks, of him and Carlos Beltran, according to Tony's research.
Right. One of the biggest people who used it as most is Marwin, and he's on the Twins, and no one cares. And even I saw somebody from Yankees Twitter tweet about Carlos Correa and said, hey, when he becomes a free agent, who wants him as his new shortstop? And everyone below it was like, yes. So it's not about, it's Orange Team Bad. It's not about the player. It's about the team. They want, you know, and I think for Astros fans, it's not so much leaning into we cheated and hate us. It's more along the lines of, okay, we're the villain now, but let's do this in a different way. Let's prove the truth. Let's bring the truth to the light. And it's not like we screwed up and, you know, screw you guys. No, it's like, we're going to show you guys what's really going on with the whole league. And everyone needs to stop putting their nose up and say, yeah, let's fix this whole thing. Why not do just earpieces for every pitcher? Just be done with it. But that's, people don't want to do that. And so you bring up the Yankee letter and people are like, no, don't do that. Because that's going to be another sense of saying, here's what's wrong with the league. Not just the Yankees, the league and Manfred and the cover up. So yeah, people just want to be mad at the Astros, and they'll do whatever they can.
Do you see any, I know we're going to wrap this up, but do you see any resolution? Like, how long do you think Astros fans are going to have to put up with this behavior that we're dealing with? And I do think to some degree, Crane has some culpability in the way he kind of rolled over for the league. And it seems like we're bearing the brunt of that.
I wish I could speak better about Crane. Maybe it seems like it would have been better if he did speak up on some things, especially the Taubman stuff. And I'm not going to say exactly what he said that could have been different. It's like in these PR situations, yeah, Maybe not speaking is the best thing. But, you know, how the media circus goes is that people will take words and they will change them up and they will hold it against you. And so in regards to what it's going to look like for the Astros for next year, it just takes winning. It takes winning and, you know, showing that people need to shut up when you see the score. And that's what always does it.
Yeah.
And over the next few years, we'll see. I mean, like, if the Astros do really well these playoffs, you're going to see the people with anger. As they keep playing and keep doing well, it's going to start dissipating. You're going to get those scragglers at the end. They're just like, cheaters. But more people are going to get on board. And there are some smart people out there. And I will tell you that there are smart people on many different teams, maybe not the Dodgers, but I will tell you on many different teams who are smart and know how baseball works. And they just want it to be better. So I wish I could tell you when that happens. But right now we are on the bullseye.
It does seem like, as we wrap up, I even noticed the tone change in game one of the ALDS, AL Wildcard, which was one of the most unprofessional broadcasts I've ever watched.
Yeah.
You and I both being in media understand that's not how you do it. But even the next day, all of a sudden, Altuve is a really likable guy. You already start to see that change.
Yep. I think even, you know, I think when players are doing a bit better and when people will be like, hey, I want them on my team at some point, or when someone calls out the media, then they'll be like, no, but we're unbiased. And that's when you're like, no, let's be honest here. We know what's going on. So, you know, I think over the next 5 years, it'll be funny to see what this all looks like. I mean, you already see Gerrit Cole is the enshrinement of a king in Yankees land. And last year he was on the worst team in the world. So it doesn't matter when they're on your team.
He stands up for that team, which I do give Gerrit Cole a lot of props for. Michael, thanks so much for being on Let's Get To. Everybody follow him. We're going to have a hot link to your Twitter link down here. And go Stros, man.
Go Stros. Thanks, James.
Ladies and gentlemen, please adjust your scorecards. We have a special guest in the lineup.
We're excited to be joined on Let's Get To on our Adjust Your Scorecard segment for our special guest, Mr. Daryl Mitchell, Austin-based actor. And as you can probably tell, Marlins fan. Daryl, how's it going?
That's right. Thank you, James. I appreciate being on Let's Get To. I love the podcast, man. I'm happy to be here. And yes, there are Marlins fans. There are some even across the country. They probably have a connection to Florida. I don't imagine a bunch of horde of people, you know, jumping on the Marlins bandwagon. But yeah, thanks for the holler and swaller the other day.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Yes, we're out there. As you can see by my vintage Marlins starter jacket, you know, I was a fan when I was a little boy.
I love that. You know, it's funny because we could have had you on to talk about a number of things because you and I are interested in a lot of the same stuff. We could be talking Michael B. Jordan as Green Lantern, but that'll be a whole other conversation. But, you know, the Marlins, I mean, I guess give them the World Series because they've never lost a postseason series. Is that how that goes?
They've never lost a postseason series, man. I think you're right. You can just pack it in and call it done because, you know, Marlins got in. They're 7-0 in playoff series. They won in 1997. They won in 2003. And then, of course, the poor fan base, those teams get completely dismantled afterwards. So, you know, South Florida has been through a lot. Hey, we're kind of built for this season, right? We're used to playing without fans. Just saying.
No, I told Scott McIntyre when he makes that joke about Tampa Bay. I say, listen, this is a positivity, but you can say it about yourself, I guess.
We might be winners in that category. You know, I think there's a lot of Marlins fans that stay home. I think, you know, the stadium isn't very good representation of how many Marlins fans there are. I think there's a lot of cheap, you know, disgruntled Marlins fans that are just happy to watch from home. So
absolutely. You know,
we're good.
Are you from the area? How did you become a Marlins fan in the first
place? Yeah. I was born in Hollywood, Florida. And of course, as an actor, I'm trying to make a manifest destiny reality and get to the other coast. But yeah. You know, I was born in Hollywood. I grew up a baseball fan. So my dad played baseball for University of Miami, the U, you know, a legit program for that legendary coach that was like winless in several seasons. So, yeah. So he grew up a baseball player. He played with some great guys. He actually was coached by Demi Maneri, who is a legendary college baseball coach. His son, Paul Maneri, coached Alex Bregman at LSU. And some other famous players at LSU. And that coach, Paul Maneri, my dad has videos of him as the ball boy in the UM dugout. So they're like talking crap to him and making him do stuff. And that's little Paul Maneri, who's now like, you know, this coach at LSU who's won like championships and stuff. So yeah, my dad had this big baseball connection, you know, so I grew up loving baseball. He's a child of the 50s, so of course Mickey Mantle's his hero. Sure. His family's from Connecticut, so they grew up, you know, huge Yankees fans. And you know, you're me and you are similar ages. If you grew up in the 80s and, you know, maybe you're a teen in the early 90s, like if you're in South Florida, your team was generally either the Braves, who were the closest logistical team, or you were a transplanted Northeasterner, so you were probably a Red Sox or Yankees fan. So chances are you like those three teams. And of course, we get the Marlins in 1993. So that's really cool. Marlins and Rockies came out that year. My parents were in a cool enough position to know some other working class families who like split some season ticket packages. I think we got two seats and they were split amongst like seven or eight families, right? So we basically got like 10 to 20 games a year we would go to.
Wow.
You know, depending on the season. So I think for the first 3 or 4 years, we had season tickets. They were like nice club seats. But, you know, even back then, those tickets were maybe like $20 face value. They weren't like huge expensive tickets. It was a football stadium, right? It was the old Joe Robbie Stadium, now Pro Player, now Shark, now Monster Stadium, whatever. They've named it a million things for the Dolphins. They've had about as many names for that stadium as they've had quarterbacks since Dan Marino has left.
You bring you here to throw some shade on the Dolphins. Before we get to some other baseball connections you have, though, what makes this Marlins team's been fun to watch? First of all,
yes,
I was telling you this in our pre-talk that probably me growing up, my favorite non-Astro and my first favorite ball player that wasn't an Astro was Don Mattingly, Donnie Baseball. You know, you've got him and Jeter doing their thing. What has made this team the most fun to watch?
Mattingly has been really fun because, you know, he's kind of a more of an old school coach. He doesn't like disregard analytics, but he's not super married to them either. And you kind of get a feeling that maybe he has a little more say so than most teams. And Jeter's kind of old school as well. So, I've followed this team through so many ups and downs over the years, mostly downs, but some really big ups. They got a fun young team, man. They really do. They traded away a couple pieces last year and they traded stars like, you know, Real Muto and Stanton and all these guys. And Jeter's stance was, hey, you had all these guys and you were still losing. So why pay all this money? We need to turn a profit. I get it. But you know what? One guy that's really huge this year, and they got him in the Real Muto deal. They got this pitcher, Sixto Sanchez, and he is amazing, man. Yeah. And they have other great young pitchers like Alcantara, who was an all-star last year, Pablo Lopez. So they're on the come up with pitching. And historically, they're pretty good at putting pitching staffs together. They got a couple bullpen pieces that are defense that are decent. They got a fun guy in Jesus Aguilar, who had a monster year a couple of years ago. And last year he had a down year. So it was a really good pickup. They made a trade for Starling Marte, who's a fun player. But mainly they just got scrappy guys, man. They really do. They don't have any big stars. I would say Brian Anderson is probably their best hitter. And, you know, he's not definitely not a household name. He's not even really a name amongst all baseball fans that you would like need to know. So they got a bunch of scrappy players who play with heart. I think Don Mattingly leads them really well. And they don't care, man. They're used to playing without a lot of support. So
they're ball players.
And they kind of play small ball. You know, they're not relying on the home run. They kind of do some old school things. I think they have a chance against the Braves. You know, by the time this airs, we'll know what happens in game one. But I think they got a good chance, man. They're a scrappy team.
I was really impressed with how they rallied around that bottom feeders thing. You know, they got the t-shirts made. I love that.
Yeah. 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 Hey, man. Hashtag fear the fish. I'm starting it right now. Okay.
We'll get that going. Before we get out of here though, I do want to drop a little bit of trivia. You've got a connection. I mean, you're also a Yankee fan, like, and you come by.
I'm a Yankees fan. So in 2003, I was so happy because the Marlins and Yankees played each other. Of course I went for the Marlins because, you know, Yankees had already won a lot, but I am a Yankees fan. I'm a Yankees fan because my dad, when he played, after he played at UM, he went back to his junior college alma mater, which is Miami-Dade Community College, which is one of the biggest community college programs in the country with the best athletics. And he wasn't the main coach, but he was on the coaching staff, and he coached Bucky Dent and Mickey Rivers, who both went to play for the Yankees. And your other beloved team, the Rangers, I think they both finished their career with the Rangers, but we won't talk about that. So he coached Bucky Dent, and they were buddies when I was born. So he's actually my godfather. And, you know, I saw him a lot when I was younger. My dad isn't in contact with him as much through the years, not for any reason. They talk maybe 2-3 times a year on the phone. So, sure. You know, they still talk. They're still buddies and stuff. But yeah, it was very cool as a young kid to see this big, handsome, muscular baseball player come around and say hi and play with you. And yeah, so I grew up a diehard Yankees fan, and then we got the Marlins, and then I have two teams, and it's nice. Maybe they'll play each other in the World Series again this year. I don't know, man.
I think 2020 is going to have an all Florida World Series. Actually, I think it's going to be Tampa Bay, Miami.
That's not a bad prediction.
I think it's going to roll. Daryl, thanks so much for jumping on. Let's get to, man.
Hey, thanks, buddy. Let's get to.
Ladies and gentlemen, please adjust your scorecards. We have a special guest in the lineup.
All right, so we are welcome to bring back to Let's Get To. Trevor, it seems like forever since you have been on this show because a pandemic happened and then we didn't have baseball. First, filmmaker from Oklahoma, Trevor Rogers, how's it going, man? How are you guys doing up there?
We're doing well, man. A lot of films shooting in Oklahoma right now, and you've got football back in the state, which I think people are probably – they were happy about the last 2 weeks, pretty bummed out about now. So, but we're otherwise doing okay.
So, you know, you're a big Sooner guy, and what you can't see right now is underneath, it's got your resume and it's got the fact that you told Bob Stoops, like scrolling underneath you, we have a German Shepherd sighting, by the way.
We do. This is
look at this, the intelligence everybody. Level of this conversation. Mine's in the hallway going, oh, what, this again, Dad? We're talking about The whole premise of this of bringing you on was talking about how cool this rivalry is. Could we have picked a worse game coming up next week to talk about this?
Man, you know, such high expectations for Texas this year. And both schools, always, you always have high expectations for both these schools. And just with everything compounds with the pandemic, the disappointing start to the season. It's so frustrating to see the best football rivalry in college football, the most unique experience, limited to no fans, the state fair is not going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's heartbreaking. And then beyond then, I don't know what kind of product we're going to get on Saturday. There's so many question marks with both these teams.
Yeah. And question marks that don't make a lot of sense to me. Like on the one hand, Oklahoma has the quarterback with the best name maybe in the history. I mean, when your last name's Rattler, you're going to be a badass. You have no choice, right? Eventually.
he's got to live up to it. And the dude's got all the arm talent in the world, but great name. Definitely. That's a quarterback name for sure.
Absolutely. But talk to people. So, you know, you and I had two different experiences with it. You know, we both have a fan experience, but you also have a media experience. And I know that my friends will bring up Michigan, Ohio State. Break us down. Why is Texas OU so unique and therefore so special?
Well, so as somebody who's been to Michigan, Ohio State before and experienced some of the other rivalries in college football, you know, obviously growing up around the University of Oklahoma and going to this game, you know, as a fan, as a student, and then, you know, working in the media, there's just being at the fair. There's nothing like it. It's the world's greatest tailgate party, in my opinion. You know, having a Fletcher's corny dog and a Shinerbach at 11 a.m. is, you know, it's something I look forward to every year. And then even beyond then, it's great football. And so it's the closest thing that you have to the environment. And even then, you know, I'd say it's still better. But to having this college football playoff, BCS, national championship, big bowl game vibe, because it's the only game where you've got 100,000 people there and it is split 50-50. And so you don't get that experience, even at the college football playoff, you know, it's a lot of donors and a lot of other people that are just there to witness the spectacle. No, this is truly two fan bases that hate each other, but also like they look forward to this so much. And being at the fair, walking down the tunnel, you know, if you talk to former players, you talk to the coaches, broadcasters, they'll tell you there's nothing like walking down the tunnel before OU Texas or Texas OU. And I know up here we call it OU Texas.
Yeah. But we don't call it the Red River Showdown on this show. It's the shootout, damn it.
It will always be the Red River Shootout. But when you walk down and, you've got this big chain link fence that keeps, because that's actually the OU side of things.
Yeah.
The south side of the stadium, you've got this chain link fence to like protect the players and personnel from, you know, drunk Oklahoma rednecks.
Right. Explain that part too, but not to cut you off, because people I think it's divided in a way where Texas comes in their side and OU comes in their side. No, it's divided the other way in both tunnels, sometimes at the same time.
Yeah. And it's, when they come out, so they've done some renovations in the Cotton Bowl and the locker rooms are in a lot better shape than they were when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And when they come out, it's amazing. Like more things don't happen in the tunnel because they are screaming at each other across the stairs. They come down the stairs and then this big long ramp. And there's so much security in there to keep both teams away from each other. It's an insane experience. And then you come out and it is, 50,000 basically on each side. You know, 50,000 is the size of most stadiums in the Big 12.
Right.
And, you know, I've been to Lubbock and it's loud. That's loud as is. But it's so deafening when both teams come out. And when you cross that 50-yard line and you're in that other team's territory, boy, it is a different world. You know, it is a road environment without being a road environment, so to speak.
Yeah.
There's just nothing like it. The contrast, the colors, the fan base, the talent. It is just an unbelievable experience. If you're a college football fan, you got to go.
You see crazy intimidation tactics. Like I remember one time OU like intentionally warming up a little bit into Texas's half of the thing beforehand. I've never seen a game from a Texas perspective where Longhorn network reporters or whatever will judge the outcome of the game based on the energy level in pregame warmups.
Like oh, no kidding. No kidding. You know, there's always jawing. You know, I've been down there a couple of years where you've seen them. There's pushing and shoving as both teams are warming up. You know, I think my personal favorite thing, and of course it ties back to, it's a Mike Leach story. In 1999, Bob Stoops first year, Mike Leach leaves a decoy playbook. And Texas picks it up and Oklahoma gets off to a big lead in the first half. And you're thinking, man, Oklahoma is going to run away with this when Texas comes back, wins the game. And but that is it. It is the showmanship. It is the theater, the spectacle that like, it's not just the football, it's everything leading up to it.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I think I have the privilege of being 3-0 at OU games that I've attended.
Oh so, man,
I
definitely don't have that record.
Yeah. What was it? Just name real quick, like one of the more memorable games that you covered when you were there.
Well, so, the most memorable one that I covered was probably we'll do this in two parts. Cause the most memorable game I went to was the Chris Sims, Roy Williams, Superman play. My apologies, but that from being a fan, being a little kid, you know, I'll never forget that experience. But the year that this was actually my last year covering the team, Kyler Murray's only year at Oklahoma as a starter, and plays terribly in the first half. You know, three crucial turnovers, two bad picks, and a fumble, and yet still single-handedly, you know, brings Oklahoma all the way back, and it takes Dicker the kicker hitting like a 48-yard field goal as time expired basically to walk away with that one. And I think I say that one's memorable because I was down in the Texas end zone when Kyler Murray breaks it off for like that 49-yard touchdown run untouched, and we see him doing this even in the NFL.
Yeah,
I'd seen Kyler Murray like the flashes of brilliance there. I've just never seen anybody play football so effortlessly than Kyler Murray from a throwing perspective. And then just running, like he almost runs in slow motion. It's so fluid. And just to that emotional swing from Oklahoma being down three scores in the fourth quarter to it's a tie game in the blink of an eye. That's what makes that rivalry so fun, is it doesn't matter where these teams are at. you're going to get at least competitive football for the most part. That was an unbelievable one.
And that is a game that will make legends. Like nobody, like if you were to take Peter Gardier's career at Texas and take away those four wins, those were very average football teams he played for. But
yeah,
I think he went 4-0 against OU, the only quarterback on our side to do that. Yeah, no, I mean, I think about, I think the most memorable game I watched, we were not there, was when, you know, Texas fans hated Greg Davis because he wasn't ever flexible. But when he put Jordan Shipley in that flex spot, basically let Jordan Shipley play tight end essentially, and it took three quarters for Oklahoma to figure out what was happening. That was,
That 2008 game.
Yeah, the 08 game.
Yeah, that one was, I know that's one that I definitely, Oklahoma fans wish they could get back. Because God, those you want to talk about the last time these two teams were really, you know, national championship contending teams, like at the same time, like truly,
yeah,
truly, you know, that 08 game was just so loaded with talent. That's probably the most balanced that I think we've seen these two teams be, maybe up until 2020, all things considered, but, yeah, that 08 game was an unbelievable game. And you know, Shipley, sure hands Shipley, like I just, OU fans rip their hat, you know, the head out of their hair, of just how efficient that guy was, you know, just what a great receiver.
But you know what I was in, I'll end the OU discussion on this. I've never actually seen, yeah, their fan bases, they hate each other. But I think there's a lot of respect between the fan bases. Cause I can tell you every time we've left a stadium after we've won, there was always a lot of, I hope you guys end up, because I still think Texas and OU still see themselves as, we need to be the blue bloods of college football. And if it can't be, like, I think rising tides for those two schools lift all boats. So it was always kind of cool to walk out going, well, I hope you guys just keep winning. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. It's, you know, somebody asked me on Twitter not long ago, like, have you ever seen a big fight at OU Texas? And I never really have at the Cotton Bowl or at the fair. You know, I've seen a bunch of drunk college kids at the West End, you know, the night before, sure. But it's two fan bases. Like, there's nothing to be angry about. It's college football and you're at the state fair. Well,
Enjoy it. Honestly, too, and some people will say it's really the Texas high school football championship, because there's so many people who played against each other. You know, I don't know. It's so much fun. And I think if I'm OU, I still feel better about the future of their program. I hate to be the guy that's maybe already calling for Tom Herman's job. I think he'd lose his job if this weren't a Corona year.
The expectations that Texas had this year and with how wide open and obviously seeing Oklahoma definitely rebuilding.
Absolutely.
And still to go out and be an onside kick away from being 0-2 in conference play, just right there with Oklahoma. Like, Tom Herman's deservedly under heat. And so I'll be here to campaign today for the Bill O'Brien to the Texas Longhorns. I don't know how Texas people feel about that, but
I'm a Cowboys fan, and so I don't know if I want that, but he was a good college coach. I mean, he was.
Yeah, he was awesome at Penn State. I mean, the circumstance that he took over that Penn State program and what he did, unbelievable. So I think the guy's a football mind. He's just not a good GM. I think he'd be a great hire. You know, some people I've seen talk about, and obviously Tom Herman's still there, so why have this conversation?
Yeah, and if Texas wins Saturday, we all know that a lot of the memories get a lot longer, and there's a lot of politics to it too. I think donors are not only unhappy with the wins and losses, they're unhappy with the team not singing the eyes of Texas. And look, honestly, I'm with them on that.
Yeah,
I get all of that, but you know, the players and everybody, they came together and they had a list of demands and some were met and they all agreed to sing the eyes and they haven't done it. And so
the two things that Texas is really, I think, missed out on. And I think one thing that they're so gun shy is, you look at the end of the Mac Brown era and it was, it was time for Mac to go. Sure. But at the same time, Mac was so endeared to Texas culture and, you know, like he just felt like a Texan. He felt like he belonged at the University of Texas and he was a politician. And I've heard some people use that against Mac Brown, saying, right, oh, he's too good at the politics of being the coach at Texas. And I get it. Texas needs a football coach, but they've gone after two guys in Charlie Strong and Tom Herman. To me, that are just way better suited for an NFL style, like just straight business. Like,
sure.
They just haven't attached themselves to the university. That's really hard to keep your job when your fans don't feel like you've connected with them.
I completely agree. And I really wish it had worked for Charlie because I actually really liked him.
Great guy. Talked with him for like 30 minutes at Big 12 Media Days about fishing of all things. And so just such a genuine down to earth dude. Good, good dude.
You know, as we wrap up, then you are kind of our Red Sox guy. There hasn't been a lot to talk about with your Red Sox, which is why you haven't appeared since the COVID started. Don't want to talk about Mookie Betts. I don't want to bring that up. I could Chris Sims you with that, but no, you know, going into this, what are you thinking about it for a manager for the Red Sox? Do you see Cora coming back or do you
think you're going to go a different way? I was about to say, I think Cora to me, I think they love Cora and I seeing, you know, what came out for Major League Baseball, a slap on the wrist. I don't know if we're ever going to know truly how involved the Red Sox really were in this.
We won't.
And I don't think the league, I don't think Major League Baseball wants that to be like, I think the Houston Astros getting hammered the way they did it hurt, to me, it hurt baseball. Like, you know, and you could, and people can be mad at the Astros all they want, but this is the league that has always been, if you're not doing something, you know, that is a little bit outside, you know, pushing the envelope and you could call it cheating, whatever you want. You're not playing baseball. And so the fact that you've got like an intern essentially be able to figure out, well, hey, let's look at the video from this. Nobody said you couldn't do it. And so I think with the Red Sox too, and beyond that, the whole league, I don't think you're going to see that happen. I don't think anybody's going to come crashing down. And I think it makes Alex Cora be very attractive again, because one, the clubhouse loves him.
Yeah.
The ownership very clearly still has a great admiration and respect for him. And that's the most important thing. And then two, the fan base is just clamoring for him.
So I agree.
I won't be shocked to see him come back. I saw that he's a leading candidate for like the Detroit job as well.
Yeah, but I think they're going to go AJ with that.
I think so too. But even beyond then, I was going to say, you look at where the Red Sox are positioned, you know, for 2021, to me, the cupboard is not as bare in Boston as it is in Detroit. And so if you really do have the option and the Red Sox are really interested in Cora, that to me, that's the hire to make. That's the way to go.
Well, I'm glad you said a lot of that too, because I think I think a little bit differently about the Red Sox being punished and the Yankees. We're never going to know what's in that letter. And I think Major League Baseball realized that they had a fan base and a team that really nobody cares about nationally, that they could at least make it look like they were punishing and let everybody get away with it. And I'm okay. I understand it from a business perspective. What I don't like is other fans equating that to means we've never done anything wrong and therefore telling me to kill myself on Twitter. Cause that's happened. So now as usual, you bring a sense of calmness to the discussion.
Deep breaths. I think look at the Astros. Clearly they're a good baseball team. You know, they're in the postseason and you know, they've got a great chance to advance. I think they're a dangerous team. I think they're still loaded with talent. And so I think they've taken their beating. They've taken their licks this year and to still be in the position that they're in. I mean, the Red Sox finished fifth in the East, so we can't even say that. it's a unique position for the Astros to be in, and time heals all wounds. Like, you know, that team will be back. And especially if they do it, you know, the right way, so to speak, but there's no scandal following it. Like, it's really tough to ever put an asterisk on the Astros because they're so loaded. They've got so much talent to just not be there.
And now on to close it out, the right-hander from Houston, Texas, James Christopher.
So that does close us out. I want to thank everybody for listening to the show, watching the web version, interacting with us online. It really does mean a whole lot. I know that the year has been weird, and this show and what you guys have meant to us has really helped me get through it. And I hope in at least a little way we've done that for you. We will be continuing to produce episodes this season. Season two will end about a week after the winter meetings. Whenever we get back from there, although I guess the way things are trending, the winter meetings will be in this very office. But we do intend to still cover the winter meetings.
We'll end season two then, and then we'll start season three on National Hat Day because it's kind of become a tradition. But again, thank you for listening. I hope that you found at least a bit of positivity and a little bit of fun in this show and maybe learned a little something from some of the different guests we brought in. Hope you all are enjoying the LDS games. It is weird that we can't really talk about results because the way we have to record the show, truth be told, none of them have started yet as I record this episode. But regardless, whether the baseball games are on or off, there's always time to enjoy Let's Get To. Like, for example, right now, it is Monday afternoon at 2:40 p.m. And OU still sucks. Hook 'em horns, baby, and let's get to it.